always be an introduction to a text before we talk about following the way of Jesus. And the introduction should basically say, before you start down this path, make sure first that you look good on wood. Or I think of my favorite University of Minnesota professors. He's dead now, Mulford Sibley. He was just a lovely, delightful teacher and well respected by the students. He walked by my office at the church where I am in Minneapolis on his way to the U every day. He looked a little bit like Ichabod Crane and always walked a lot. And he gave a lecture. He was a thoroughgoing pacifist, a Quaker, just as centered as any man I have ever met. And he gave a talk about pacifism, and there was a similar response to him. You are not realistic about evil in the world. You are not a realistic man. And he got that kindly look, said, oh, you couldn't have misunderstood me more. We who call for this nonviolence, we have seen evil. We have seen it so clearly, just shatteringly clearly, that we refuse to have any of it in our response to it. It's kind of a second naivete after you know the awfulness of evil and what kind of world it is, to choose an alternative to that. Now, is this the great effort that, you know, you said this is a heavy, or is that only possible when there's the fruit of the Spirit or the gift of the Spirit, or that we are remade or we are reborn? Or can you by willpower and techniques learn nonviolence? There's certain things you do, there's certain things you say, there's certain ways you hold your body. Will that do it? That's what we're going to explore at this time. And I'm going to give a, we haven't done this to each of the sessions, I'm going to give a kind of overall festival to what we're talking about this time. April Fool's Day. I'd like to nominate that we begin to celebrate. Holden would be great. I mean, we can take any festival you want. So I'll leave that as my request. I won't be here, but celebrate April Fool's Day at Holden. The other day we got the history of Valentine's Day at the microphone. If you look up the history of April Fool's Day, I just think it's delightful. I called up the reference library in Minneapolis. I was asked to preach at Augsburg College on April Fool's Day. Well, yeah, I could have had a lot of fun with it, but I wanted it to also be substantive on that day and be a worship service. So the reference library at Minnesota said, it's not for sure, but most people agree that this is the origin of the day. There was a time in Europe when the calendar began on April 1st. That was the new year. So that the days prior to that were days in which you celebrated and you gave a gift on April Fool's Day. It was a national holiday and was a gift-giving day. They changed the calendar and went to January 1st, or whether they joined the rest of us or whether all of us were on that, I didn't ask the reference library. But some people are always slow and they continue to give gifts on April Fool's Day. So they were called fools. If you gave a gift on April 1st when you weren't supposed to, you were a fool. We're far from that now. But I thought, isn't that a marvelous way to celebrate the Christian faith, especially if we would emphasize, love somebody who doesn't deserve it. That's what God did. Be a fool on that day. So for the Augsburg College students, I gave the story of a man that I met in Iowa, a Lutheran pastor who did not have a call and was almost at the point of depression, and the synod couldn't get him a call. He took the only thing available, prison chaplain, just dreaded it. But he really just needed a job, he told me. Didn't feel called. And he went and he said, I didn't know what to do. So I learned to play cards. And I learned to listen to bad jokes and to hang out with people that I wasn't comfortable with. I just went day after day, and I was there. And I tried to speak, and I tried to learn to know people. Then one day, he was coming through the gate. They had to unlock it and let him into the prison. And he heard one prisoner say to the other prisoner, "Ha, here comes the fool who cares." And he said, "You couldn't get me to leave there now. Somehow, in spite of myself, I'm where God wanted me to be." And he said, "I'll be glad to be known as the fool who cares." So that's really what we're going to talk about this morning. And I think one of the ways to do that is with stories. I could give you the brief mini lecture about Gandhi and Satyagraha and Ahimsa, and that may be helpful. Gandhi created a word to describe what we're talking about this morning, truth power. He created that word so that it wasn't a negative, Ahimsa. In the language, Himsa was violence, Ahimsa was nonviolence. And that's what we talk more about. But it's a negative. It's the absence of something. It's not positive. And he wanted it to be, he wanted to be an active word. So Satyagraha, soul power or truth power, was one of Gandhi's gifts. And then people who were Satyagrahi, who followed that, that was one of the times in the history of the world where a whole nation, where it became a political action, a large group of people committed to that, was one of the times that we saw that that really could be power. Well, Ray and I are doing a somewhat similar thing. We're trying to find a positive way to talk about where this nonviolence, and we're testing whether or not freedom is really not only a state of being, but a possible way of living, a positive force, a truth power. And we're just trying to check that out by using Galatians and some songs and some stories. So let me tell you one story, and then I'd like Ray to sing a song that, again, comes from his family and from his daughter, because I think we're often held back by fear. I don't know all that it means, perfect love casts out fear, but I think the resistance is just a kind of natural fear for our own safety, our own life, and that many times we don't live fully because we have a slavery of our own fear, and so we don't reach out. If you want to understand a little bit about nonviolence and the possibility of facing enemies, then a story like this one. Once upon a time, there was a general of an army who set out to conquer the whole kingdom, village by village. And he had enough force that nothing had stopped it. Village after village fell before his army and before his kind of ambition. And so the villages found out that they probably couldn't resist with armed force, and they found other ways to resist. And this particular village that he came to that day, all of the men simply left and went to the woods because it had been proved that he was kind of a manly general and didn't harm women, children, older people, the infirm. So when he got to the village, there were no men to fight, and he was frustrated. He said, "Are there no men at all in the village?" And the answer came back, "There's one man, the priest, and he's in the church." General went with an aide, stood before the church, bash through the door. The priest didn't even look up. He was reading from his book and working at his desk, and the general said, "Do you not know that a man stands here who can run you through with this sword without batting an eye?" And the priest still didn't look up. He only answered, "Do you not know that a man is sitting here who can be run through without batting an eye?" And the general gave a polite nod and left. He had confronted a kind of power that he didn't quite know how to deal with, but he understood that he was before a man who was not a coward, and that had his own kind of strength. We're not talking about fear, neutrality, cowardice. What other words would push nonviolence too far? Maybe we'll come to some. But fear often is not only childish or childlike, it's our own experience, right?
The night is gently falling on the happy times we've had today. I've brought you a glass of water once again. Before I tuck you in and say goodnight, I love you. Is there anything you'd like to talk about or ask of me, my daughter? You're looking worried. Tell me, what's it all about? Is it something that the kids have said at school? Did they scare you in their ignorance? Did they hurt you in their pride? Did they laugh at you? Did they make you feel the fool? You can tell me. You can tell me. You can tell me. I won't laugh at you. You can tell me. You can tell me. You can tell me. I won't laugh at you. What's that you say? It's not any of the things I've mentioned. They said something else that's got your attention, and you think I'll think you're silly if you say it. Well, I don't think that I will think you're silly. I've heard some mighty silly statements in my time. I expect that I'll be hearing more. So the kids are saying the world will end in 1984. Minneapolis will have a war next year. And you're thinking maybe we could move to England before then, 'cause they've had their war, so they'll not have one again. You can tell me. You can tell me. You can tell me. I won't laugh at you. You can tell me. You can tell me. You can tell me. I won't laugh at you. Now that I'm listening, you want to know if there are really bombs so big that they could kill people high up on the hill, at the same time folks are dying in the valley. Why the men with guns would come and roam the streets where children run, hide in alleys, up on roofs, shoot at anything that moves. Well, I don't know what to say when you ask me why there's war. I've never heard a reason I believe in. If you're feeling frightened, I'm not surprised. Of course, I'll hold you while you go to sleep. Now rest your eyes, you're oh so wise. You can tell me. You can tell me. You can tell me. I won't laugh at you. You can tell me. You can tell me, you can tell me, I won't laugh at you.
Thank you. I'm going to ask somebody to turn those lights on. I think if we have the power, it's that I can't see you at all. I see only the bright windows. Thank you. What do you think of when you hear nonviolence or enemy love, or who do you think of, or what reaction do you have to it? Let me just kind of see where we are before we tell a couple more stories.
Peacefulness.
Peacefulness? Thank you. Do you feel at enmity? By the way, I chose that word specifically. Ray has the definition too. Not anger. I think anger is okay. I think it's had a bad, people have been told not to be angry. I think that's counterproductive. So be angry and sin not. But I specifically did not put anger. Enmity is the bitter attitude or feelings of mutual enemies, hostility or antagonism. Do you feel that in your life? Do you have enemies? Is it a slavery at all for you? Maybe people aren't going to share in this size group, but some are nodding.
Well, it's sad because there's so much anger out there. Mm-hmm. And people not getting in touch with the anger within. Deal with the anger from outside.
Uh-huh. Okay. Can you all hear when someone speaks so I don't have to repeat it? Thank you. Other people?
Well, I was just thinking, I don't go jogging anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out it does make me angry.
Yes. So it has restricted your activities because of...
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Other people live differently with security systems and kind of an attitude that we didn't have some years ago.
Carl Lyons.
Mm-hmm.
I pull my drapes at night.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when you hear love your enemy, How do you respond? I mean, I asked before because I have given presentations. I've never given one where I wasn't called either naive or unrealistic. Or when you hear that, what does it say about what it means to be followers of the way? I mean, we all kind of agree that we're living with some fear and that we're probably not what we should be in regard to this part of the freedom in Christ? Does it feel guilt-producing, or does it feel heavy, or beyond what you can do? Or
I think maybe an analogy, when I commute to work by bicycle, when I get on the bicycle in the morning, I sort of put this imaginary steel shield around me and go down the street praying nobody hits me.
Uh-huh.
And I think that sometimes when we talk about loving your enemies, that's sometimes what you have to do. You have to put a shield around so that what these people with animosity can't get to you, can't mm-hmm. get to the spirit that allows you to
mm-hmm.
do something.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you think that Jesus decided that one person was his enemy and one wasn't, or did he love everybody the same?
I don't know. What do you think?
It seems to me that your enemies disappear when you love everybody.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you. I was going to put in here, cultural assumption, enemies are to be destroyed. And I thought of where I first heard that quote. Abraham Lincoln was talking in his cabinet about real compassion for the South after the Civil War, of mercy to the enemy, and was really asking even for the conduct of the war to have more compassion to it. And he had a Secretary of War, Thaddeus Stevens, a particularly harsh and angry man, and he said, "Mr. President, enemies are to be destroyed." And the history books have Lincoln's answer. "Mr. Stevens, do not I destroy my enemy if I make him my friend?" That was maybe one of our finest hours in the U.S. series of presidents. Very, very interesting response to how you destroy enemies. Yes, Margaret?
But it becomes frustrating when you find out sometimes that your enemy is your neighbor.
Mm. Yes.
You know, my boys are very gentle boys.
Yeah.
But at some point in those teenage years, I would have to say to them that people will fear you because because you are a black male.
Mm-hmm.
I have nothing to fear for my children. They're good children. But just be aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you think, these people kind of become my enemies because my sons are black males who for some reason have gotten bad shtick and, you know, my sons are incorporated in them. And my neighbors are then kind of my enemies.
Yes. Yeah. We had a young law student in the Community of Christ in Washington, D.C. He was able at this point to laugh at himself, a young black student from the South who had come to Washington, D.C. to go to Howard Law School and didn't know you had to go to college first. When he told the story, he could laugh about how really naive he was when he came. And once in a while, he really leveled with us. We were 90% white in the Community of Christ. He was a minority. I think the time he leveled with us the most clearly was, I want you to know that when I grew up, everything was hate whitey. And he described how he had been treated as a small black boy in the South. Older white boys would grab him, pull him by his feet with his head down in sawdust till he thought he would choke and then laugh and leave it. And he said, the only part of that mix was Muddy, the woman who raised him, not his real mother, and he couldn't say mommy when he was little, so he called her Muddy. We got to meet her once, a delightful woman. She always said, don't hate anybody, it'll destroy you. This was the influence he kept getting. Then I came to Howard University, and Muddy was gone, and it was all clear. Hate, white. This was in the midst of the civil rights and the real anger, and the city was ready to burn, and it did. And he said, I want you to know that you all have complicated my life. I have it all straight. All my classmates, all the language at 14th and U from Stokely Carmichael, all of the brothers, it's going to be, we're going to get them. And I start to school, and Mary Schramm comes out to get the Washington Post at the same time and says, have a good day, Alex, and damn it, I can't hate her. So part of it is to move from person you know, stranger, enemy, to move back to where that's not a stranger anymore. But part of it is that. That's not all of it. There are some criminally insane people. That changes the thing we're talking about. Or there are some psalms. Go through the book, and I think most denominations, go through the book and see the ones they left out. Did you ever do that? Which ones are they?
The ones where you're real angry.
Real angry. One time we had a session in here where Chuck Mayer was the village philosopher, and he took all the psalms that were left out of the hymnal and we chanted them back and forth across this room. The imprecatory psalms. And it's, my enemies, God, smash them in the teeth. Bash their babies against the rocks. Oh, man. So that's not in the hymnal. Do you know what those psalms do? That our society and the people who put that hymnal together, basically middle class, white, comfortable people, they didn't know that those psalms are the way you get in touch with your rage. And that there are people who can pray those psalms and are not surprised by them. And so there are a lot of aspects where you can push this too far and not really be touching the human condition. But don't lose the possibility of the fruits of the Spirit. Don't lose the possibility of shields as you're going that are somewhat different from what the culture advertises. Our Minneapolis Star Tribune just had a full-page ad on new women's clothes that have a holster in the coat for the gun. I mean, they had a whole, it's a whole new wardrobe for you. Don't lose the possibility of being peculiar people in the midst of all of that fear. Let me tell you a story. Our community includes a woman who is a nurse. She has all the fears that you all have. In fact, she works at Abbott Northwestern Hospital, lives in North Minneapolis, which is a tough neighborhood, and sometimes rides a bus home and gets home at 11 o'clock at night. But of all the people I know, I don't personally know anybody as thoroughly committed to nonviolence. I mean, I've read about the biggies, Dorothy Day, Gandhi, and Martin Luther King, but I don't know anybody who is just so far beyond me and so inspiring in the way of nonviolence. She's had a lot of experiences. She's done videotapes for the Roman Catholic Church and Pax Christi on nonviolence. And I said before, you can't take a course and have certain techniques and therefore pull it off, but there are some things that help. Looking your enemy, the one that you're confronting, directly in the eye, keeping the voice low, knowing physiologically, some aspects that give you some defenses. Did you know that you couldn't have at the same time awe and wonder and anger? It's impossible. So the Catholic worker woman that night in New York, when a rapist broke in and she was alone in the house and he leaned over her bed at 2 o'clock in the morning and she woke up, the first thing she said was, "What time is it?" And he said, "It's 1 o'clock." And she said, "Huh, my watch says 2:30. And he said, "No, I think it's 1 o'clock. He was done. He was he was done. Physiologically, she got him into wonder and awe or question, and the rage and the aggressiveness was gone. So there are, don't just think of all the manuals and disciplines of more violent ways to defend yourself. Well, there's a whole history of nonviolence too. So when we say it's not realistic, we haven't put the dollars into peace that we've put into war, and we haven't put the training into this that we've put into other kinds of ways to relate, including defense, manual arts. Okay, you'll find you've touched a button this time with me of a long history, so I keep doing aside. Maggie had been thoroughly disciplined in that. One night she got off the bus at 11 o'clock. She knew better. She made the mistake, instead of walking on the more lit street, she went under this one place where there was a kind of bridge and some trees, and out came an arm. And she was being dragged by a man. And she thought through as much as she could. She started by saying, "My name is Maggie. I just got off work. I'm a nurse at Abbott Northwestern. I have three children waiting at home for me. What's your name?" I mean, she did all of the things, but she was also afraid. Then a little man came by, walking his dog, and Maggie had to make a basic decision. Do I call for help, and maybe two of us can get me out of this? And then she also has a good sense of humor. She said, "Then I looked, and he was really little." And his dog didn't look like a scrapper either. I'm going to further aggravate this guy, and I'm going to get the little guy hurt. So she did a kind of moral jujitsu, and she grabbed her attacker, and she said, "You're coming with me." And she pulled him to hide them both from the guy walking his dog. And then she began to talk, and she looked him in the eye. She said who she was again. She asked him who he was. And by then there was a little bit of relaxing. 2 hours they talked, sitting in this culvert. Vietnam vet, drugs, the whole bit. Angry, probably a little bit unbalanced, the whole bit. Maggie was cold, for one thing. She knew her family was worried, for another thing. So she said, "Look, this is really a... Would you walk me home? And it did. Excuse me. The next day, in front of her screen door, there was a bouquet, not very fancy, and it said, "Thanks, you're the only one who ever listened." She was foolish, April Fool. When she told the story, do you know what people said? "Well, you could have been killed." Do you know what she said? "I was ready to die. I didn't think he should. He wasn't prepared to meet his maker at all." Would it be freeing to be that nonchalant, in the best sense, about your own life even? Would that be a kind of shield? Don't dismiss it. That's the history of the Christian church, much more than we ever say. That's our tradition. Let's sing about three strong, what is it? Oh, Devil Time.
Yeah, good. Okay.
Well, you know the songs better than I do.
Hard for you to sing in this one. It goes like this.
My lovers gather round and help me rise to fight you one more time.
It just kind of comes at the end of each verse. It's my lovers gather round and help me rise to fight you one more time. I'll sing it one more time and sing along softly if you want.
My lovers gather round and help me rise to fight you one more time. Oh, Devil Time, I'm gonna fool you. Devil Time, you'd like to bring me down when I feel low. My lovers gather round and help me rise to fight you one more time. Oh, Devil Fear, your icy hand. Oh, Devil Fear, you'd like to freeze me cold, but when I'm afraid, my lovers gather round and help me rise to find you one more time. Devil Hate, I knew you long ago, before I learned the poison in your breath. But when I hear your lies, my lovers gather round and help me rise to fight you one more time. Storm nor fire can ever beat us down. No wind that blows but carries us further on. And you who fear, oh lovers, gather round, and we will rise to fight you one more time. lovers gather round, we will rise to sing it, and we will rise to sing it one more time.
Yesterday, when Ray and I were planning this session, and we tried to say, well, how could enmity, though, enslave you or keep you from freedom? I mean, it seemed more like you chose this as an approach to enemies, but how was it in some way an imprisoning thing? Then I thought of the story of the two ex-prisoners who had been imprisoned in a prisoner of war camp. And the one said to the other, have you forgiven our captors? And he said, yes, I have. And the first one said, I never will. I don't see how you could. I will never forgive them. And the other said, then they still have you in prison, don't they? There is a way in which the enmity cuts down our freedom. And I think the business of for freedom Christ has set us free includes even that radical forgiveness is a freeing thing, and that when we don't do that, there is a sense in which it's enslaved. I want to tell a couple stories about, because it's Black History Month, and because Martin Luther King Jr. is part of that, and because the civil rights movement was the one experience in my lifetime of people committed to nonviolence where I saw it and in some way was a part of it. I want to share that, and there is a good song to lead us into that.
Okay.
Three Strong Links.
This is a song by a fellow named Jim Manley, who I don't know. Some of you may know who Jim Manley is. He's got a sing-along chorus, and this is it. So listen carefully and then sing with me.
Three strong links in a freedom chain. Three strong links in a freedom chain. Three strong links in a freedom chain. A Jew and a Hindu and a black man slain.
I'll sing first, then we'll do the chorus again.
One walked the road to Calvary. One walked for salt to the Indian Sea. One walked for freedom in Montgomery. A Jew and a Hindu and a black man, three. Here we go.
Three strong links in a freedom chain. Three strong links in a freedom chain. Three strong links in a freedom chain. A Jew and a Hindu and a black man slain.
In the face of hatred, each taught love. In the face of hatred, each taught love. In the face of hatred, each taught love. They were wise as serpents, they were gentle as doves.
Strong links in a freedom chain. Three strong links in a freedom chain. Three strong links in a freedom chain. A Jew and a Hindu and a black man slain.
Three strong links in a freedom band. Three strong links in a freedom band. Three strong links in a freedom band. Circle is open, so take my hand.
Three strong links in a freedom chain. Three strong links in a freedom chain. Three strong links in a freedom chain. A Jew and a Hindu and a black man slain.
Thank you. Two final stories, both from the civil rights movement. One has to do with a sit-in. I think you probably remember that seems a very, very small thing to do, to go in with an integrated group and order a Coke at a lunch counter. But that was one of the things that was done in the civil rights movement. And the other has to do with voter registration, which is still one of the things that this country needs, but was part of that civil rights movement. First story has to do with a Quaker young man that I knew in Washington, D.C. named David. He went with other people to the Deep South to participate in those sit-ins. And when he got back, he told the story that I'm sharing with you. All of my stories are true, and some also really happened.
This one's both. David and one other white man and two black friends went into a lunch counter to order a Coke. I have lived in the South. In fact, in 1953, when I moved to Annandale, Virginia, there were diners in Fairfax, Virginia that said whites only. So it got that far north. You lived in Herndon or Annandale and northern Virginia, and so it was pervasive throughout the South. Double drinking fountains and double everything. So for them to sit in there was moving through that law that they considered immoral, but it was also antagonizing the people for whom that had become a way of life. He said you could feel the tension in the room because the drugstore was fairly full and it had caused more attention for them to enter, so other people came in. He said as he sat there, he felt in the middle of his back the unmistakable feeling of a knife. And I've already told you a little bit about nonviolence, and David was thoroughly prepared in it, so he turned so that he was face to face with this one who was angered by his action instead of the knife being in his back. But now it meant that the knife was right here at his heart. And David looked this man in the eye and he said, I don't think I ever saw any more anger in my life than I could see in the eyes of that man. And he spoke. And he kept it down, kept it soft. And he said, friend, now you have to know he meant that. That's not just a beginning. There's no power there if he didn't mean that. I don't know how he could mean that, but he meant that. Friend, whether you push the knife in or not is obviously up to you. It's not up to me. I want you to know, in either event, I love you. And the man's hand shook and the knife fell to the floor and he just turned and whipped and ran out of there. Now, if you take the history of the world, more often than not, the knife goes in. You know that? Well, I know that too. I know that. I'm not saying it's a new way to get what you want and not get hurt. No way. What am I saying? That man was ready, the opponent was ready for another knife. He was ready for a lot. He was not ready for this. And it was power. That's all I'm saying. It was not the absence of power, it was power. I think we have minimized the possibility of that being a power that we use individually and certainly have never considered it as a national policy. Second story is about voter registration, and you need to know the characters on this one. It doesn't make any sense unless you know who we're talking about. The primary character is Will Campbell, Southern preacher, worked for civil rights in the South, even though he was deeply connected all of his life with the South. He had a brother named Joe, and Joe always kind of worried about Will, especially when Will was too outspoken for integration, and Joe knew what some of the other people who lived in the town might do to this preacher who was always with black people and trying to work for integration. Those are two of the characters. In fact, there's a book about their relationship called Brother to a Dragonfly. It's a marvelous book. The third character you need to know is P.D. East. Not P.D., P. period, D. period, East. If you've ever lived in the South, you know that's his name, P.D. Now, he's a character. He is a sarcastic, very smart, arrogant, kind of kidding all the time, little bit of sarcasm most of the time, lawyer, and very anti-religion. He's Will's friend, so to speak. How would you like to have a friend who was always saying when the news was bad in the paper, well, I wonder what Mr. Jesus says about this. How would you like to have that as your friend if you were the pastor? I wonder what Mr. Jesus would do here. Or always got on Will by saying, you Christians are Easter chickens. And what he meant by that was he said, last Easter we got my niece a chicken for Easter. It was purple. Funny little thing. It was different from all the other chickens. And we put it out, and for a while it was different. Gave it about a week, Will, and it was in the pecking order with all the other chickens. Gave it a couple weeks, and when the feathers came out, it wasn't purple at all. It was a Rhode Island red. That's what you Christians are like. Put you down somewhere, and within about 2 weeks, you can't tell you from all the other folks. You're Easter chickens. You got PD? PD had a long time conversation with Will. It was a challenge. Will, if you could define Christianity for me in 10 words or less that I could understand, I might be one. Will had never done very well with the challenge. But just before our story starts, you have to know that Will came up with the challenge, and he said to PD, you said I had 10 words. I'm not going to use them all. I'm going to use only 8. This is what Christianity is, PD. We're all bastards, but God loves us anyway. PD said, well, it's less than 10 words, and I can understand it. I'll give it some thought. Well, you did pretty good. Okay? Ready for the story? There were people who came down to the South for voter registration, and one of those was an Episcopalian seminarian named Jonathan Daniels. Of all the people who came, he was Will's favorite. Will said to Joe many times, if I'd had a son, I'd have wanted him to be like Jonathan Daniels. I think he's the finest young man I have ever met. He really loved him. One day, Jonathan Daniels and a couple other people doing voter registration got arrested. It was a Catholic priest and 2 young local black people who were doing the voter registration. They got arrested, taken into the sheriff's office, and then after they were questioned, they were released without any escort at all. And coming through town in a pickup truck was Thomas Coleman, deputy sheriff of Hayville, Alabama. Shotgun hung in the rack in the back window of his pickup truck, and he saw those integrationists, so he got out his gun and he opened fire. He wounded the priest. He killed Jonathan Daniels. The 2 young blacks got away through an alley and got away. Joe knew it, Will's brother, but Will was traveling and didn't know anything about what had happened. So Will came home. Joe said, Will, you know a Jonathan Daniels. Do I know him? Will said. He is the finest young man I have ever met. And Joe said, he's dead. And Will just slumped. Put his head down. Just wept. And Joe kind of left him alone. And P.D. East came over. In the middle of Will sitting there, PD said, was Jonathan Daniels a bastard? And Joe said, for God's sake, PD, you don't have a brain in your head. Let him alone. PD said, no, I've got to know. Was Jonathan Daniels a bastard? And Will said what you'd expect him to say. He was the finest. I know you liked him. But you know, our work and definition, the work and definition you gave me of Christianity, according to that, was he a bastard? Will finally said, yeah, I guess so. P.D. said, how about that Thomas Coleman who shot him? That one was easy. Will said, yeah, he was a bastard. And then P.D. came over and he put his bony fingers right on Will's knee and he got his face about this far from Will Campbell. He said, okay, Will, which of the bastards did God love the most? And Will got up, and he kind of bounced off the walls of the room. He was laughing and crying at the same time. PD and Joe just looked at him. What was going through his head was a theological education that he had never gotten in Baptist Sunday school, Christian college, or theological seminary. If loved, then reconciled. And if reconciled, then brought into the family. What happened in just a few moments in that room opened up for what was, for the rest of Will Campbell's life, a ministry for integration and also a ministry to the Klan. He realized he could cut no one out of God's love or his love. All of that was going through his head. That's why he was both laughing and crying. And he stopped long enough to look at P.D. East and said, P.D., I didn't use all 10 words, did I? No, I think you used only 8. Well, I'm going to use all 10 of them right now. We're all bastards, and you're the biggest bastard of them all. And P.D. said, what do you mean, Will? What is that all about? And Will Campbell said, because, P.D., you're about to make a Christian out of me, and I don't think I can stand it. April Fool. Don't miss lunch. Thank you all very much. Tonight it's a concert at 8 o'clock.